It's important to investors. Yeah. Everybody in this room is an investor. I'm like doing all the geopolitics and the games theory and everything else. But what this is really about is about rewiring the world's energy system so that we never have to be blackmailed by a bunch of evil people, British, Persian, Israeli, whatever, ever again over a choke point like the Strait of Hormuz. Since the war started, over 9 million barrels a day that used to flow through the Strait now flow either into the Gulf of Oman, out of the UAE, who just left OPEC, or across to the Red Sea, across the Arabian Peninsula from Saudi Arabia. That's roughly half of the oil that used to flow through the Straits of Hormuz. So everybody out there today screaming, well, the Straits aren't open. Who cares? 75% of the oil that used to go through the Straits, because the other 25% of it's going to the Gulf of America. And we're exporting 6 million barrels a day. And Venezuela just came out this morning, and where they're exported 1.27 million barrels a day, up 40% since Maduro was taken off, was exfiltrated and sent on a paddy wagon tour of Broadway. Yeah. And is now turning state's evidence against Obama and everybody else who stole the 2020 election. Because that's his job. Mm-hmm. So it's all happening. It's right in front of your eyes. But what Trump is really doing is just forcing everybody to finally properly price the risk of having single points of failure in the global trade. Taiwan is no longer going to be a single point of failure for technology. Why? Because he's building Taiwan Squared in Arizona. If you don't know what's happening in Arizona, it's crazy. I have a guy on the ground who texts me all the time. He's an executive Uber driver. Literally, he shuttles TSMC executives back and forth from the Phoenix airport to the factories. That's what he does for a living. He's got them in the car for 45 minutes. He just like takes pictures and video every day. He's like talking to these people about what's going on. He's like, you have no idea how much chip capacity we're building in Arizona. By the way, you're worried about helium? Yeah. You know where the biggest helium reserves in the world are? Northeastern Arizona.
Right. We have a helium company here, guys.
So, I'm like, Taiwan, let's take that off the board. The Straits of Hormuz, let's take that off the board. Let's not let Iran have a nuclear weapon so they can't attack Gibraltar or the Suez or the Gulf of Aden or the Straits of Malacca. Remember the ballistic missile that was launched against Diego Garcia?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the specifics on that for a second, just to give you an idea of what I'm getting at here. That missile was a message from somebody, and I don't know who inside Iran, but I'm gonna posit for you what I think, which is the following: they kept saying, well, we can only send our missiles, 2,000 kilometers. And, that missile was obviously under trajectory. They could go 3,000 kilometers. Well, you know how you get a missile that can only go 2,000 kilometers to go 3,000 kilometers? You put a small warhead on it. Now the same amount of fuel can send the missile farther. It's just physics, folks, right? It's not, they have a different missile. They just took the same missile, put half the warhead on it, and shot it at Diego Garcia. Now, why would the IRGC do that?
Why?
Well, I don't think they did it. I think that was the Iranian civilian government trying to tell everybody that the IRGC are a bunch of crazies that need to be. I think Iran has been a country at war with itself since day three of the war. And you see it every day. Well, they negotiate, then they don't negotiate. Every time Aragachi, the foreign minister, goes to says something in public, he then gets like the big hook from the IRGC guy who then sends him back out there. The next day, he looks white as a sheet and says something else. Every day you're just watching the exposure of who's actually running Iran, and you find out it's just been the IRGC the entire time. It was never the mullahs. It was just like it was never Maduro. Mm-hmm. Maduro wasn't in charge in Venezuela. You know who's in charge of Venezuela? The cartels. Colombia, Cuba, the Mexican cartels. That was who was in charge. By the way, we killed all those guys.
Yeah.
That operation, I think we killed 1,500 people.
Yeah.
Okay? So, what's happening is that all of this old layer of organized crime and chaos and everything else is being removed from the board so that the global trade can get more predictable. We have more predictable trade. We have more predictable investment. We have more predictable investment. We can actually build things and actually make a profit on them. Like, I don't even know how we operate as a species when the most important commodity on the planet trades between 5 and 7% of its price a week. A week. 7% of price. Before the war, when it was trading in $50 a barrel, it was $50, $60 a barrel, oil's range on a weekly basis was $4.72, five-year running average. Okay? That's almost 8%. Now at $100 a barrel, yeah, it's 5%. Okay, fine. But it's not going to be $100 a barrel forever. It's going to go back to 50. When it goes back to 50, is it going to go back to 50 with 7% volatility? No, it's going to go back to, if I'm right, we're going to go back to 3% volatility like it was pre-Biden. Before he started dumping I watched it in real time when they started dumping the SPR on the market. The oil volatility doubled during the Biden junta. I refuse to call it the Biden administration, by the way, for anybody in the room, because it was a junta, right? So when you ask yourself, okay, why would you use oil? Why would oil volatility be a thing? Well, who profits off the volatility? The insurance companies, the people creating the chaos. They're on both sides of the trade, folks. They're creating the chaos and then charging you a premium for the chaos. That's the world we live in. That world needs to end. And
is that world ending?
I think that Donald Trump is trying to end that world. I don't know if he will be successful. I'm happy to have that conversation. But as of May 2nd, the jury is still out. Do I think he's winning? I think he just hosted the King of England, and the King of England was walking through going, please don't forget about us as you move and go back to the moon, like America. But the King at the same time was also openly telling Congress, start a civil war in the United States. Stand up to the demon Trump. Stand up to creamsicle Mussolini, as my partner Dexter White likes to call him, right? I'm like, okay, that's nice, but how? And then when that happens, when Charles is getting ready, and there are no coincidences in geopolitics, by the way. There are no coincidences. Things happen on a schedule for a reason. There are massive Gantt charts at every one of these Microsoft Project Files at every one of these centers of power. Yeah. I don't care if we're talking about the European Union, Chatham House, the White House, whatever. They all have Gantt charts. And so on that morning, we had the UAE announce they're leaving OPEC with 3 days' notice. We have the Supreme Court finally stop slow walking the decision about the Voting Rights Act, which now is forcing redistricting of half the country to shore up the midterms. He's going to force John Thune, Senate Majority Leader, to pass the Save America Act and if that doesn't happen, he'll just declare an emergency over the election and put ICE agents at every polling station in America for the election, which then, you know, and now you start thinking tactically. Now you start thinking like the British. You start thinking like a chess player. Well, I force you into that move because then that's going to be bad for him politically, and then we can activate our blue state governors to declare independence against, you know, the King Trump. I'm like, no, that's not going to happen. What's going to happen is that all the blue state governors will announce that, and then the military is going to go in and they're going to arrest them all. Like, that's the world we live in, folks. We live in a world of power politics now. The world of consensus politics is over. It's been over for 10 years. It was never not power politics. We just made it look like it was consensus politics. The Iron Fist was always inside the velvet glove while they were having meetings at Davos and Chatham House and, you know, the Atlantic and, you know, the Atlantic Council and all that stuff, the Council on Foreign Relations, all that stuff, all those things. So when you back out and you look at the strategy, which is what you should be doing, because that's where Trump operates. Trump doesn't operate tactically, folks. He operates strategically. He leaves the tactics to his underlings. Right. Right? He turns to his Secretary of War and his Joint Chiefs of Staff and go, give me an attack plan on Iran. This is what I want to achieve. Yes, sir. Are you ready? Yes, sir. Go. And literally, we attacked Iran in the middle of the day, 5 minutes after Gerald Ford said, yep, we're on station, go. Like, you never attack during the day. You always attack at night. So, like, they were that confident at that point. Like, there were all these little signs, all these little things that tell me these people knew exactly what they were doing and why. And it doesn't matter, you know, if they have setbacks. The enemy always gets a vote. The enemy's always going to do something in response to whatever it is you've done, right? That's the way the game's played. But the question should always be, are you trying to achieve your particular strategic goal? And I can make the argument that from Iran's perspective, they think that, well, as they've been telling everybody, all they have to do is survive and they win. No, not really. If you're not pumping oil, if the Straits of Hormuz is no longer your choke point, and I'm not saying that the Iranians aren't moving oil around. They are moving some. What I'm saying is Iran is not the focus of this war. The focus is getting control over the price of oil. And who controls the price of oil?